Preparing for this particular podcast, I've had a picture in my mind of where the story from John chapter 5, which we're looking at today, takes place. As many of you know, a few years ago, I had the privilege of taking a tour through Israel. And on our last day of the tour, while in Jerusalem, we visited what's called the Pool of Bethesda. It's located to the south of the kind of the main temple complex in Jerusalem. And for many years, people actually doubted the veracity of the story that we're looking at today because they found no evidence to suggest that there was actually a pool like this Pool of Bethesda. But as so often the case, it wasn't that the story wasn't true, it was just that there was time that was needed for the discovery of the pool, which is what happened at Bethesda in the 19th century, and then later further work was done in the middle of the 1900s. Archaeologists discovered two very deep pools verifying the account while putting the mystery to rest. Perhaps if I recall, when I upload the podcast later on, I'll include a few pictures to help you give a visual frame of reference for where this story takes place. The pools themselves were very dramatic, plunging it with these deep staircases into the water below, and it was believed that the pools, among other purposes, were used to ceremonially wash the sheep and other animals before entering the temple to be sacrificed. Directly next to the pool, when we were there anyway, sat a church, St. Anne's, I believe it was called, obviously built many hundreds of years after the time of the story we're looking at. And after our time around the Pool of Bethesda on our tour, we stopped and went into this church. It was blessed with the most incredible echoing architecture, the incredible acoustics. And while we were there, our little tour group sang a couple of hymns together. It was a really beautiful, wonderful way to end our time in the city of Jerusalem. Okay, enough reminiscing, though, for me. I could go on about that all day. For now, let's read the story found in John chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, and then we'll dig into the teaching for this podcast. Sometime later, this was after Jesus had healed the official's son and had the encounter with the woman in Samaria. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for a feast of the Jews. Now there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Now, a little stop here. There was apparently a superstition at the time that an angel wings would from time to time stir the water, and that the first person to get into the pool would be the first person to be healed. And this man, the invalid, was lamenting that any time the water is stirred, he doesn't get the chance to get down there. So the story continues on. Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and he walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath, and the law forbids you to carry your mat." But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" And so they asked him, "Well, who is this fellow who told you to pick up the mat?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. Later Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you're well again. Stop sinning or something worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jews persecuted him. Jesus said to them, "My Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working." For this reason, the Jews tried all the harder to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. Well, as you recall, in the last teaching, the last podcast, if you listened in, we saw that Jesus performed what was called in that section his second sign. And as I said, from this point on, the detectives, we are being called to be like detectives sleuthing our way through the clues. And we would be left to determine from here on out what the other signs would be. Well, it just so happens that as we turn the page now to chapter 5, we already find ourselves in a story that looks suspiciously like another sign that Jesus is performing. Now, again, a quick refresher on this, and I know that I've done this for the majority of the teachings so far, but I feel I need to in case some people might be jumping in having not heard the other teachings and then getting lost as to where we're going. So if you've heard this before, just bear with me. I'll breeze through it fairly quickly. But as you recall, the first half of the gospel occurs around these things, for lack of a better word, that were very important to the Jewish people. In chapters 2 to chapter 4, the stories all take place around these important articles for the Jewish people, like ceremonial jars, or like the temple, or even in the last story we looked at, like the sacred well. But now, as we turn the page to our story here in chapter 5 today, we get the hint that a switch is beginning to happen. As the chapter begins in chapter 5, verse 1, it says that Jesus was making his way to Jerusalem to celebrate a feast of the Jews. And what we need to understand now is that from here on out, all the stories begin to happen around the Jewish feast. So from chapter 2 to chapter 4, they happened around these important articles. And now from chapter 5 on through to chapter 12, they happen around the feast of the Jews. And what we have seen is that Jesus uses all of these important things, the articles in the feast, to reveal something about himself. He takes them, uses them almost as objects of illustration to say something about himself. But what we've also seen is that in seven of the various cases, he also performs signs or performs miracles around these things that are also connected to these things. As one person I read put it, the signs are like illustrations that bring further light into what Jesus was saying about himself. And this is exactly what we see happening in our story today. In verses 9 to 10, Jesus, it says, is acting on the Sabbath. Now, the Sabbath is the only of the Jewish feasts that occurred on a weekly basis. All the rest of the feasts for the Jews were on a yearly occasion, but the Sabbath happened every week from sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday. And Jesus, as we're going to see in this story, is going to use this very sacred day, the Sabbath, to reveal something new about himself to those that are looking in. But on this day, as we'll see, he's also going to perform another sign. He's going to do another miracle, and it reveals something, again, even further about Jesus. If we have eyes to see as we're reading along, this really is the third sign in the gospel. The first sign, he turns water into wine. The second, he heals the official son. And today, on the third sign, he causes an invalid to walk. Okay, so with that background knowledge in mind, the question then that we need to be asking ourselves as we study this is, what is Jesus trying to reveal about himself by acting on the Sabbath? And then further, how is it that the sign that Jesus does contributes to what it is that he's trying to say about himself? Well, in order to answer these questions, we need to first make sense of the Sabbath itself. So let's just take a few moments and explore the Sabbath and remind ourselves perhaps of a few things about the Sabbath. First of all, the Sabbath, probably most of us know, was a day of rest. It was commanded. It was a command for the people of Israel to take every seventh day as a day of rest. It was given to the people of Moses as a part of their law. And in fact, actually, the command to have a Sabbath rest sat at the very core of that law. In the opening five books of the Bible, which is known as the law or the Torah, the people of Israel were given 613 different distinct laws that they were to follow. There were 613 laws that set the people of Israel apart from all the other nations on the earth. But at the core of these laws sat the Ten Commandments that were found in Exodus 20. These were the most sacred of all the commands. These, in some ways, summarized all the rest of the 613 articles. And sitting right there at position number 4 was the command to be a people that keep a Sabbath. And so it goes without saying then that taking a day of rest to worship God was at the very heart of the people of Israel. This was central to their identity, and it was deeply sacred. If you were a Jew, if you were from the people of Israel, you every seventh day took a day to rest. Now here's the problem with this, though, is that while the people were told to cease from all work, when you look at the scriptures, you discover there really wasn't much given to interpret what this actually meant. Now, what was work and what wasn't work? And so being a very studious and dedicated rule-keeping people, even as many of the religious Jews are today, the question became very perplexing. And so in the thousands of years after Moses, right through to the time of Christ and perhaps even beyond him, the priests and the leaders of Israel set out with the task of interpreting further what this actually meant for the people in practical terms to keep the Sabbath. And over time then, they developed really 39 broad categories of work that was prohibited on the Sabbath, which at first pass seems fairly workable. I mean, certainly all of us could think, well, for one day a week, we could probably avoid 39 different things that we're not supposed to do. It seems like, okay, we can do this, until you realize then that these categories really were just broad categories, and they were then further parsed into the most minutiae of detail. Let me just give you one example, okay? So one of the categories of work to be avoided was winnowing, the act basically of removing the chaff from the grain. And again, when you think about that, I think alone that seems fairly passable. I mean, surely any one of us could avoid one day a week from removing the chaff from the grain, and we could, were that all it meant. But in time, it came to be understood that winnowing was actually, when they broke it apart, well, what is winnowing? It was actually the act of removing the unwanted from the wanted. And so soon, any act of separation along these lines became deemed as work. Removing bones from fish so you could eat the fish. Well, this was really winnowing. It was removing the unwanted from the wanted, and so therefore it was work. Filtering water to remove the impurities. That was winnowing, and okay, work. Removing the skins from peanuts. I'm not joking. Removing the skins from peanuts. Well, that was work. And you could see then where this could lead. And this was just one of the categories. Winnowing was just one of 39 categories that were broken down into all these various things. And so by the time of Jesus, the list of activities that were deemed as work was huge, articulating all sorts of things that people were to avoid: walking distance, how many stitches you could sew, what you could and couldn't untie on the Sabbath, even what you could carry, like mats, which you couldn't. Somehow they had determined that God didn't want people stitching on the Sabbath, and nor did he want them carrying mats, and nor did he want them taking the skins off their peanuts. However, as they made their Sabbath list, they ran into a very evident and obvious snag. Well, what about God? I mean, did God have to obey the Sabbath rules? If he did, maybe he had special rules that pertained only to him. I mean, when you think about it, and I suppose better, when they thought about it, it came to the thought, well, surely God couldn't cease and desist from all work, otherwise the world would collapse. They knew from their own scriptures, from their own writings, that God held the world together, that he held the oceans back. All of these things were his work that he did. And so if he ceased from working, well, the world would fall apart. The sun would fall. The underworld would run wild. The oceans would begin to flood their banks, and on it went. And so it was determined that God himself was free from the Sabbath, or from at least all of the rules and the details, and therefore the only person then that was allowed to work on the Sabbath was God. Only God was allowed to act on the Sabbath. And so here then is where the story in John 5 comes back into focus. We'll come back into the story here. Well, this is the first time we see it in John's gospel. When we read through the other gospels, it becomes quickly apparent that Jesus seems to almost make sport of doing miracles on the Sabbath. I mean, when you consider it, he didn't ever have to do anything on the Sabbath, but it was almost like he chose to, knowing full well all the rules that were set up around Sabbath keeping. I mean, I think even about our own story. The guy in the story had been an invalid for over 38 years. Surely if Jesus had wanted to, he could have said and waited another day. He could have said to the guy, listen, I can't do it today because it's the Sabbath, but I'll come back tomorrow and we'll make you whole again when I'm allowed to work. But today I can't do it. Just hang tight one more day. You can do it. I'm sure the man would say, oh, okay, sure, I'll see you tomorrow. But no, instead, Jesus deliberately intends to heal him on this day, the day that no one was to work except for God. So the question is, given all we've learned by doing the sign of healing on this day, what was Jesus saying to the people? Yeah. Pretty clear, isn't it? Jesus acted on the Sabbath because, as John 1 stated in the prologue, he understood himself to be the Word of God made flesh, God who had come to dwell among us in the skin of a man. Jesus understood himself to be God. It's interesting how often people argue and say, well, Jesus never really articulates that he is God. That may be true in some readings only if you have no clue of the Jewish Hebrew understanding or the context behind these things. When you dig into it, you realize over and over and over again, Jesus is very clearly articulating, insinuating, declaring his divinity. And if we doubt this interpretation, if we doubt that this is what Jesus is doing or what he's trying to say on this particular day by healing and working in this way on this day, the Jews definitely didn't share the same doubt. They knew full well what he was saying. We see this even by what we read toward the end of our passage in verse 16 to 18. Listen to what it says there again. So because Jesus was doing these things like healing on the Sabbath, the Jews persecuted him. Jesus said to them, this makes a whole lot more sense given what I've just said to you now. Jesus said to them, my Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working. For this reason, the Jews tried all the harder to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. He was making himself equal with God by calling God Father and by working on the Sabbath. See, the Jews knew full well exactly what it was that Jesus was doing and exactly what it was that he was declaring. And they were so incensed by it here that they set out to kill him. Which, interestingly, this is the first time we hear about this plot in the gospel. This is where it begins, right here, with Jesus working on the Sabbath. And what gets it all rolling was that he was talking blasphemy. He was acting like God, and in so doing, he was declaring himself to be the same as God. All Jesus' Sabbath work throughout the Gospels wasn't just happenstance. He could have avoided the day like everyone else did. It was a declaration of identity. And to many, it was also a declaration of war. Now, that said, let me draw something else out for you that's important for us to understand. You see, you notice Jesus' directions to the man. They are repeated four times over four verses. Clearly, they are repeated because John, the writer of the gospel, wants us to see something. The words are, pick up your mat and walk. Now, they're bold words that Jesus was saying to this guy on this day. Bold because the religious law keepers had clearly designated that picking up your bedroll and walking were things that God didn't want people doing on the Sabbath day. And it seems that Jesus' instructions were directly aimed at these very rules. It's like he zoned right in on them and said, pick up your mat and walk. And it's repeated all of those times so that we would almost hear them echo for us as we read the story. Pick up your mat and walk. I suspect he probably even said them with a bit of a Clint Eastwood, dirty, hairy inflection in his voice. You know, go ahead. Make my day. My man, pick up your mat and walk. But Jesus, there's rules about these kind of things. The religious keeper, the keeper's law of the law, they keep a tight rein on this kind of thing. Sabbath work is going to get us all in a lot of trouble. Pick up your mat and walk. Why was Jesus so belligerent with their rules? Why is it that he even goes right at them? Not only does he work, but he just goes right at them four times. Pick up your mat and walk, specifically commanding these things that they felt were strictly forbidden. No one in Jerusalem was carrying their mat and walking on this day. No one. And that is just the problem. No one in Jerusalem was carrying their mat, nor were they picking bones from fish, nor were they cleaning the skins from their peanuts, nor, you see where I'm going with this, and they weren't, because they had created this religious framework of tyranny around a day that from the very beginning had been created actually for the people. And Jesus even said as much. He said, the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. It was a day for their rest, for the people's rest and enjoyment, for their refueling, for their fellowship with God and with each other. It was a day that was intended to give life to people. It was a day to breathe in God. Yes, to cease from work, but this was not to be replaced by rule keeping that was even more onerous and burden bound than the work itself. The day was to be filled with joy and rest, play and feast. Surely there could be wisdom and freedom in discerning what not working looked like. But the religious rules had spun this all around so that rather than resting and enjoying, they weren't walking or carrying, all while pointing vindictive fingers at each other, looking at one another, trying to find out who was doing something wrong. What was intended to be the highlight of the week, the climax, the great seventh day of rest had become the most loathsome, burdensome, pain-filled, ugly day of all. And here then is the real upshot of this, is that in so doing, they had then created an image of God for themselves and for their children as one who actually cared about such stupid nonsense, instead of a God who actually cared about the real heart of the Sabbath, a God who cared about rest and life and feasting and joy and worship and healing and, oh, all these wonderful things. So when Jesus in this occasion then gives his best Dirty Harry, it wasn't just an affront to their rules, it was also an affront to their vision of God, and perhaps more positively, it was an invitation then to see in him the true nature of God. See, by working on the Sabbath in this way, he was saying to them, first of all, I am your God. And by telling the man to pick up his mat and walk, he was saying, and this is what he looks like. He is a God who gives life and rest and shalom wholeness. Jesus hadn't just come to reveal that he was God, the one free to act on the Sabbath, but he had also come to reveal the nature of God, a God who had been obscured by a tangled web of ridiculous rules, which is perhaps the greatest trouble with religious rule keeping. Our legalism is that not only does it tangle us up and encumber us in things that we were never intended to be encumbered by, but more dangerously, it actually tangles our image of God. It makes him into something he's not. Now, one more thing, if I can add to this, if I may, come back into the story again with me. Here was a man whose whole life, best we can tell anyways, had been lived as an invalid. And it wasn't because of his sin that he had lived this way, but the sin and the brokenness that is in the world had manifested itself in him in this tragic way. His body was broken because the world itself was broken by sin. That is what the scripture teaches us. So if anyone was in need of a quote-unquote Sabbath rest, that is, if anyone was in need of freedom and joy, it was this guy. If there was anyone for who the words pick up your mat would have been a real Sabbath invitation, not a call to work as they were saying it was him. For 38 years in a culture without any social network, he had been lying in poverty and discomfort at the edge of a pool of superstition. He was tired. He was in need of restoration and wholeness. He was in need of an invitation to step into Sabbath. And then along comes Jesus, and he speaks these words that I'm sure this man thought he would never hear. Get up. You want to be well? Get up. Now, it's an interesting expression because the Greek word behind it is actually the same word used for resurrection. Hey, man, you want to be well? Be resurrected. Get up out of there. Come on up. Get up. Be resurrected. Do you see this? Do you hear what's happening? The man then wasn't just tasting freedom from his mat. What he was actually tasting was the first glimmer of the resurrection. He was getting a foreshadow of the day when Jesus would say to all of creation, get up! Get up, everyone! Be freed from your sickness! Be freed from your graves! Be freed from all of your pain! Be freed from all of the effects of a world that has been bound in sin! Get up! Get up! Be resurrected! Your final full day of Sabbath rest has come! Everyone, get up out of there! The book of Hebrews even envisions this day. It even calls it the day of Sabbath rest. It calls the day of resurrection the day of Sabbath rest in Hebrews chapter 4. And this was the God that Jesus had come to make plain on this day, a God who carried with him in his back pocket the dream of the day of full Sabbath rest, the God of the resurrection. And as incredible as this announcement is, the sad sideline of the story is that the legalists, the rule keepers, they miss it. They miss seeing the true nature of God because they're too busy trying to protect their own construct of him. He, the real God that Jesus is revealing on this day, is about resurrection life, the rest of God offered to a world that's been bound in sin. But they have made him into a curmudgeonly shopkeeper who cannot rejoice even when they are watching invalids walk. This is what our legalism does. It causes us to miss seeing the fullness of God. It shapes him into something that he has no intention of ever being. And perhaps most dangerously of all, it envisions him to the world as the opposite of what he truly is. The world longs, it aches to see a God like Jesus, a God that celebrates 38 years of invalids tasting the first fruits of resurrection rest. But legalism gives them a God who seems more concerned about paltry checklists filled with silly do's and don'ts. Do you have eyes to see what's happening in the story? This isn't just a healing at a pool on a day when these kind of things were not supposed to happen. It isn't just a, hey, look, Jesus is a nice, compassionate miracle worker, which is true, he is. It's a sign. It's an act of Jesus intended to reveal something about himself. On the one hand, Jesus is declaring his intentions to be seen as God, but on the other hand, he was also revealing for those with eyes to see the true nature of God. Men had twisted the Sabbath into a labyrinth of rules, and in so doing, they unwittingly made an image of God that betrayed his nature. And at a pool called Bethesda, Jesus was stealing the image back. This wasn't just a miracle. It was a revelation. It was a sign. One final thought. The place Jesus did the miracle is called, we saw earlier on, Bethesda. Literally, it translates into house of grace. Bet, house, Seda, grace, house of grace or house of mercy. Now, isn't that interesting? House of grace. You think? I mean, when you think about it, it's almost as if Jesus planned to do the sign on this particular day at this particular location. Of course he did. On a day that feasted on the oppression of legalism, and on a day that had created God in that image, Jesus performs a sign. He sets the record straight. God was not the cantankerous rule broker of the sky. He was the mediator of grace and mercy and resurrection life to a world that was bound in pain. And then, as an added wink, wink, he did it all at a place called the House of Grace. And if you look really closely into the story, you can see even the mischievous little twinkle in his eye.